A Terribly Strange Bed by William Wilkie Collins with Michael Robert Brown. Shortly after my education at college was finished, I was staying at Paris with an English friend. We were both young men, living a wild life in that delightful city. One night, my friend proposed a visit to Frascati's, but his suggestion was not to my taste. I knew Frascati's by heart. I had lost and won plenty of 5-franc pieces there for amusement's sake until it was amusement no longer, and I was thoroughly tired of the ghastly respectabilities of a respectable gambling house. "For heaven's sake," I said, "let's go where we can see genuine, blackguard, poverty-stricken gaming with no false glitter. Let's get away from Frascati's, and go to a house where they don't mind letting in a man with a ragged coat, or with no coat, ragged or otherwise." "Very well," said my friend. "We needn't go far to find that sort of company. Here's the place just before us, as blackguard a place by all report as you could possibly wish to see." In another minute we had arrived at the door and entered the house. When we had left our hats and sticks with the doorkeeper, we were admitted into the chief gambling room. We did not find many people there, but few as they were lamentably true types of their respective classes. We had come to see blackguards, but these men were something worse. There is a comic side in all blackguardism, but here there was only tragedy. The quiet in the room was horrible. The thin, haggard, long-haired young man, whose sunken eyes fiercely watched the turning of the cards, never spoke. The flabby, fat-faced player, who pricked his piece of pasteboard to register how often black won and how often red, never spoke. The wrinkled old man, with the vulture eyes and darned greatcoat who had lost his last sou, never spoke. Even the voice of the croupier sounded dull and thick in the atmosphere of the room. I had entered the place to laugh, but the spectacle before me was something to weep over. I soon found it necessary to take refuge in excitement from the depression of spirits which was fast stealing on me. Unfortunately, I sought excitement by going to the table and beginning to play. Still more unfortunately, as you will hear, I won. Won prodigiously. Won incredibly. Won at such a rate that all the players crowded round me, staring at my stakes with hungry eyes, and whispering to one another that the English stranger was going to break the bank. The game was Rouge et Noir. I had played it in every city in Europe as idle amusement. I never resorted to it by necessity, because I never knew what it was to want money. Nor did I play so incessantly as to lose more than I could afford, or gain more than would throw me off my balance by good luck. In short, I had frequented gambling tables as I frequented ballrooms and opera houses, because they amused me, and I had nothing better to do in my leisure hours. But this occasion was different. For the first time in my life, I felt the passion for play. My success first bewildered, then intoxicated me. Incredible as it appeared, I only lost when I attempted to estimate chances and played accordingly. But if I left everything to luck and staked without any care or consideration, I was sure to win. To win in the face of every recognized probability in favor of the bank. I staked higher and higher and still won. The excitement in the room rose to fever pitch. There was a chorus of oaths and exclamations every time gold was shovelled across to my side of the table. Once the imperturbable croupier threw his rake to the floor in fury at my success. Only my English friend preserved his self-possession. He came to my side and begged me to leave the place, satisfied with what I had already gained. Several times he repeated his entreaties, and only abandoned me after I rejected his advice, in terms which rendered it impossible for him to speak to me again that night. Shortly after he had gone, a voice behind me cried, "Permit me, my dear sir, permit me to return to you 2 napoleons which you have dropped." "Wonderful luck, sir. I give you my word of honour, as an old soldier, in my long experience, I never saw such luck as yours. Never." "Go on, sir. Go on and break the bank." I turned and saw a tall man dressed in a braided greatcoat. If I had been in my senses, I should have considered him suspicious. He had bloodshot eyes, mangy moustaches, a broken nose, and the dirtiest pair of hands I ever saw. These little peculiarities, however, did not repel me. In the mad excitement of the moment, I was ready to fraternise with anyone who encouraged me. I accepted the old soldier's offered pinch of snuff, clapped him on the back, and swore he was the most glorious relic of the Grand Army that I had ever met with. "Go on," he cried, snapping his fingers in ecstasy. "Go on and win, my gallant English comrade. Break the bank. Break the bank." And I did go on, at such a rate that in another quarter of an hour the croupier called out, "Gentlemen, the bank has discontinued for the night." All the notes and all the gold in that bank now lay in a heap under my hands, the whole floating capital of the gambling house waiting to pour into my pockets. "Tie up the money in your pocket handkerchief, my worthy sir," said the old soldier. "Your winnings are too heavy for any pockets. There, shovel them in, notes and all. Stop, another napoleon on the floor. Now then, sir, 2 tight double knots and the money's safe." "And now, as an old soldier of the French army, what remains for me to do? I ask what? Simply this, to beg my valued English friend to drink a bottle of champagne with me and toast the goddess Fortune before we part." "Champagne, by all means," I replied. "An English cheer for an old French soldier. Another cheer for the goddess Fortune! Hurrah! Hurrah!" We toasted. We drank. We toasted again. "Bravo! The Englishman, the amiable, gracious Englishman. Another glass. The bottle is empty. Never mind. Vive le vin! I will order another bottle." "No, no," I insisted. "Your bottle last time. My bottle this. A toast! The French army, the present company, the croupier, the croupier's wife and daughters, all ladies, everybody in the world." By the time the second bottle was emptied, my brain was aflame. No excess in wine had had this effect on me before. Was it because I was in a highly excited state? Was my stomach disordered? Or was the champagne amazingly strong? "I am on fire," I cried out. "Do you hear, hero of Austerlitz? A third bottle of champagne to put the flame out." But the old soldier wagged his head and placed his dirty forefinger by the side of his broken nose. "Café," he cried, and ran off into an inner room. The word coffee seemed to have a magical effect on the rest of the company. As one, they rose to depart. Perhaps they had expected to profit from my intoxication, but finding that my new friend was preventing me from getting dead drunk, they abandoned all hope of thriving on my winnings. Whatever their motive, when the old soldier returned, we had the room to ourselves. Only the croupier remained, eating his supper in solitude. A sudden change came over my companion. When he spoke, it was in confidential tones.
"Listen, dear sir," he said. "Listen to an old soldier's advice. I have been to the mistress of the house to impress on her the necessity of making good and strong coffee. You must drink this coffee to get rid of your exalted spirits before you go home. You must, my good friend. With all that money, it is your duty to have your wits about you. Several gentlemen tonight know you to be a winner to an enormous extent. They may be very worthy and excellent fellows, but they are mortal, no, my dear sir? And they have their weaknesses. Need I say more? You understand me? What we must do is send for a cab when you feel well again. Draw up all the windows when you get into it, and tell the driver to take you home only through large and well-lit thoroughfares. Do this, and you and your money will be safe. And tomorrow you will thank an old soldier for giving you a word of honest advice.
At that moment, the coffee came in, ready poured in two cups. My friend handed me one with a bow. I was parched with thirst and drank it at a draught. Almost instantly I was seized with a fit of giddiness. The room whirled round. The old soldier seemed to bob up and down like the piston of a steam engine. I was half deafened by violent singing in my ears, and a feeling of utter bewilderment and helplessness overcame me. Unable to rise from my chair, I stammered that I felt dreadfully unwell, so unwell that I did not know how I was to get home.
My dear friend, said the old soldier, and even his voice seemed to bob up and down, it would be madness for you to go home in your state. You might be robbed or murdered with the greatest ease. Tonight I will sleep here, and you may do so too. Take a bed, sleep off the effects of the wine, and go home safely with your winnings tomorrow in broad daylight.
I had but two ideas left. One, I must never let go of my handkerchief full of money. The other, I must lie down somewhere immediately and fall into a comfortable sleep. I agreed to my friend's proposal, and stood to take his arm, my money secure, in my disengaged hand. The croupier led us along some passages and up a flight of stairs. At the door of the room I was offered, my companion shook me warmly by the hand, proposed that we breakfast together, and the two men left me for the night. At the washstand I drank some water, poured the rest into the bowl and plunged my face into it, then sat in a chair and tried to compose myself. I began to feel like a reasonable being again. My first thought was the risk of sleeping all night in a gambling house. My second, of the greater risk of getting out after the house was closed, and going home alone at night through the streets of Paris with a large sum of money. But I had slept in worse places than this on my travels, so I determined to take my chance till the next morning. Accordingly, I secured myself against all intrusion, locked and bolted my door, and moved against it an old wooden chest. I looked under the bed and into the cupboard, tried the fastening of the window. Only then did I put my candle on the hearth and get into bed, the handkerchief full of money under my pillow. But I could not go to sleep, nor even close my eyes. Wide awake and in high fever, I tossed and rolled and tried every kind of position on the bed. I thrust my arms over the clothes. I poked them under the clothes. I shot my legs straight down to the bottom of the bed. I coiled them up as near my chin as they would go. I shook my crumpled pillow, patted it flat, and lay down quietly on my back. I fiercely doubled it in two, thrust it against the board of the bed, and tried a sitting posture. Every effort was in vain. I groaned with vexation, as I was in for a sleepless night. What could I do? I had no book to read, but unless I found diversion for my mind, I might imagine all sorts of horrors, suffer forebodings of every danger. In short, I might pass the night in all conceivable varieties of nervous terror. I sat up and looked about the room, brightened by a lovely moonlight. While my eyes wandered, I remembered a delightful little book by Le Maistre, Voyage autour de ma chambre, and resolved to imitate him by making a mental inventory of every article of furniture I could see. First, there was the bed I was lying in. A four-poster with the top touching the ceiling, lined with chintz and stifling curtains which I had drawn back against the posts. Then there was the marble-topped washstand, from which the water I had spilled still dripped onto the brick floor. Two small chairs with my coat, waistcoat and trousers flung on them. A large armchair with my cravat and shirt collar thrown over the back. A chest of drawers with two brass handles off, and a broken china inkstand placed on the top. The dressing table, adorned by a very small looking glass and a very large pincushion. An unusually large window. A dark old picture of a sinister ruffian in a Spanish hat with a conical crown and towering feathers looking upward. The picture caused me to look upward too, at the top of the bed. It was gloomy and uninteresting, and I looked back at the picture. I counted the feathers in the man's hat. 3 white, 2 green. I wondered what he was looking up at. It couldn't be the stars. Such a desperado was neither astrologer nor astronomer. It must be at gallows, and he was about to be hanged. Would the executioner come into possession of his hat and plume of feathers, I wondered? I counted the feathers again. 3 white, 2 green. My thoughts began to wander. The moonlight in the room reminded me of a night after a picnic party in a Welsh valley. The drive homeward through moonlit scenery came back to me, though I had not thought of that day for years. Here was I, in a strange house, in an uncertain situation, remembering an event which I had thought forgotten for ever. And what had caused me to do so? Nothing but some rays of moonlight shining in at my bedroom window. I was still thinking of the picnic and of the young lady who quoted Childe Harold that evening, when my attention came back to the present, and I found myself, I knew not why, looking at the picture again. Good God! The man had pulled his hat down on his brows. No, the hat itself was gone. Where was the crown? The feathers, 3 white, 2 green, not there! In place of the hat and feathers, what now hid his forehead and his eyes? And did not the wall itself on which the picture hung seem much lower than before? I turned on my back and looked up. The top of the bed seemed much closer to me. Could that be? Was I mad, drunk, dreaming, giddy again? Or was the solid canopy really moving down, slowly, silently, throughout its length and breadth, upon me as I lay underneath? My blood stood still. A deadly, paralyzing coldness stole over me as I turned my head on the pillow and, to test whether the bedtop was really moving, kept my eye on the man in the picture. The dull outline of the valance above me was now within an inch of being parallel with his waist. As I watched, steadily, slowly, the figure and the line of frame below it vanished as the valance descended further. I am anything but timid. I have more than once been in peril of my life without losing my self-possession, but when I realized that the bedtop was steadily sinking down upon me, I looked up helpless and panic-stricken as it advanced closer and closer. I lay motionless, breathless. The candle had gone out, but moonlight still brightened the room. Down and down, silently came the bedtop, and still terror bound me to the mattress. Down it sank till the dusty odour from the canopy came stealing into my nostrils. At that last final moment, the instinct of self-preservation startled me out of my trance, and I moved at last. There was just room to roll sideways off the bed. Without stopping to draw breath or wipe the cold sweat from my face, I rose to watch the bedtop. I was spellbound by it. If I had heard footsteps behind me, I could not have turned. If a means of escape had miraculously appeared, I could not have moved. My whole life was at that moment concentrated in what I saw. The whole canopy came down so close that there was no room to squeeze a finger between the bedtop and the bed. I felt at the sides and discovered that the top concealed a thick, broad mattress. Looking up, I saw at each corner the four posts rising hideously bare, and in the middle of the bedtop a huge wooden screw that came down through a hole in the ceiling. The frightful apparatus had moved without noise. There had been no creaking as it came down, nor the faintest sound from the room above. Amid the awful silence I beheld, in the civilized capital of France in the 19th century, a machine for secret murder by suffocation as might have existed in the worst days of the Inquisition. I still could not move. I could hardly breathe, but I began to recover the power of thinking. My cup of coffee, I realized, had been drugged, but instead of killing me, had preserved my life with a fever that kept me awake. The two wretches who had led me into this room were determined to kill me in my sleep by the most horrible contrivance. I shuddered at the idea of how many men, winners like me, had slept in that bed and never been seen or heard of again. Then suddenly the murderous canopy moved once more. After it had remained on the bed, as nearly as I could guess, about 10 minutes, it began to rise. Slowly and silently it rose towards its former place. When it reached the ceiling, neither hole nor screw could be seen. The bed became in appearance an ordinary bed again, the canopy an ordinary canopy, to even the most suspicious eyes. For the first time, I was able to move, to dress myself, and consider how I should escape. If I betrayed by the smallest sound that the attempt to suffocate me had failed, I was certain to be murdered. Had I made any noise already? I listened intently, looking towards the door. No. No footsteps in the passage outside. No creaking tread from the room above. Absolute silence everywhere. I looked at the door. I could not remove the chest I had placed there. My blood ran cold as I thought of what its contents might be, without making some noise. Besides, to escape through the house, now barred for the night, was insanity. Only one chance was left. The window. I crept to it on tiptoe. My bedroom was on the first floor and looked out onto a back street. I raised my hand to the window, knowing my chance of safety rested on a hairbreadth. If the frame cracked or the hinge creaked, I was a lost man. It must have taken me 5 minutes, 5 hours, it seemed, to open that window. I succeeded in doing so silently, and then looked down into the street. To leap down would be almost certain destruction. I looked round at the sides of the house. Down the left side, a thick water pipe passed close by the window. The moment I saw the pipe, I knew I was saved. To some men, the means of escape which I had discovered might have seemed dangerous. To me, the prospect of slipping down the pipe into the street suggested no peril. Since a schoolboy, I had been an expert climber. I got one leg over the windowsill when I remembered the handkerchief with money under my pillow. I could have left it behind, but I was determined that the miscreants of the gambling house should lose their plunder as well as their victim. I crept back to the bed and tied the heavy kerchief at my back by my cravat. As I made it tight, I thought I heard breathing outside the door. The chill of horror ran through me as I listened. No, dead silence still. It was only the night air blowing softly into the room. The next moment, I was on the windowsill and had a firm grip on the water pipe. I slid down into the street quietly, and immediately set off to a prefecture of police, which I knew in the immediate neighbourhood. A sub-prefect and several subordinates happened to be there. When I began my story, breathless and in very bad French, I could see they suspected me of being a drunken Englishman, but the official altered his opinion as I went on, and before I had concluded, he ordered his men to assemble tools for breaking open doors and ripping up flooring. Away we went through the streets, the sub-prefect cross-examining and congratulating me in the same breath as we marched at the head of our formidable posse. Sentinels were placed at the back and front of the house the moment we got to it, and a tremendous battery of knocks was directed against the door with a cry of, "Open in the name of the law!" At that order, bolts and locks gave way and revealed a waiter half-dressed and ghastly pale. "We want to see the Englishman who is sleeping in this house," said the sub-prefect.
"He went away hours ago," the waiter replied.
"He did no such thing. His friend went away. He remained. Show us his bedroom."
"I swear to you, Monsieur le sous-préfet, he is not here.
I swear to you, Monsieur le garçon, he is. He slept here. He didn't find your bed comfortable. He came to us to complain of it. Here he is, among my men, and I am here to look for a flea or two in his bedstead. Renaudin," he called to one of the subordinates, "arrest that man. Now then, gentlemen, let us go upstairs."
In very little time, every man and woman in the house was secured, the old soldier among the first. I identified the bed in which I had slept, and with the sub-prefect went into the room above. There appeared to be nothing extraordinary there. The sub-prefect looked round, stamped twice on the floor, and ordered the boards to be taken up. Lights were produced, and we saw a deep cavity between the floor and the ceiling of the room beneath. Through this cavity there ran a case of iron, and inside the case the screw which communicated with the bedtop below. Beside it were extra lengths of screw and levers covered with felt, all the works of a heavy press constructed to join the fixtures below and, when taken to pieces again, to be hidden in the smallest space. After a little difficulty, the sub-prefect succeeded in putting the machinery together and, leaving his men to work it, descended with me to the bedroom. The smothering canopy was then lowered as I had seen it in terror an hour before. As every one of the inmates of the house were being removed to prison, I asked the sub-prefect if he thought that men had been smothered in that bed, as I had almost been.
"I have seen dozens of drowned men in the morgue," he answered, "with letters in their pocketbooks stating they had committed suicide because they had lost everything at the gaming table. Do I know how many of those men entered the same house as you? One as you one? Were suffocated in that bed as you nearly were? Then thrown into the river with a letter written by the murderers? No. No man can say how many have suffered the fate from which you have escaped."
The rest of my story is soon told. The next day I was re-examined. The gambling house was searched from top to bottom, The prisoners interrogated, and two of the less guilty made a confession. The old soldier was master of the place, drummed out of the army years before and guilty of all sorts of villainies since. He, the croupier, another accomplice, and the woman who had made my coffee were all in on the secret of the bedstead. The three men went to the galleys. The woman was imprisoned for I forget how many years, and for one whole week I became the lion of Parisian society. One good result came from my adventure. It cured me of gambling ever again. The sight of a green cloth with packs of cards and heaps of money on it is forever associated in my mind with the sight of a bed canopy descending to suffocate me in the silence and darkness of night. That was A Terribly Strange Bed with Michael Robert Brown, written by William Wilkie Collins, abridged and directed by Martin Foreman.
Arbury, drama and fiction. Hear more drama and fiction, old and new, on arburyproductions.co.uk.